Good morning. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Tom Mann, a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program, and I'm delighted to welcome you to our post-State of the Union speech event. I am joined by a stellar cast of my colleagues here at Brookings. To my immediate left is Karen Dinan, who is Vice President and Co-Director of the Economic Studies Program. To her left is Rob Puentes, who is a Senior Fellow working within the Metropolitan Policy Studies Program. To my right is Eshwar Prasad, who is a professor at Cornell University, but most importantly, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and works in the Global Economy and Development Program. And to his right is Martin Indyk, Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program. We are dividing our event this morning into two panels. The first, and I don't want this to shock you all, is really going to focus on policy. So if some of you want to get up and leave, you know, really, we've had a lot of talk, political talk this morning, and that's important. But the first session is designed to focus directly on policy. And the second session, with colleagues of mine from Governance Studies, is to look at the linkages between the State of the Union speech and the election campaign and what might or might not be happening on Capitol Hill. So that's our plan of attack. And I'm going to spare you my personal ruminations on the speech, Gary, so just live with that. And we're going to begin with Karen. Those of you who were watching the speech may have noted that about the time it began, or perhaps just before, the administration released an associated document called Blueprint for an America Built to Last. So the question we begin with is that a serious document? Does it focus on the real problems the country confronts now economically? And is there anything fresh that we ought to be especially attentive to? Karen?
Thanks. So what the blueprint does is it elaborates on what was in the speech. And, you know, turning to the speech, what's interesting was as I was watching people react to the speech over my Twitter feed last night, the term that kept coming up again and again was laundry list. And I think that's right. I think the speech laid out many, many, many specific policy proposals, but didn't really weave them into a single narrative. I think the good part of that is that he made the case for what government does. He moved the debate from, do you like big government to do you like small government to, you know, here's a list of things that government does or might do. Do you like them or not? And that seemed good. But what the speech lacked was a clear fiscal plan to address our most significant economic challenges. So first and foremost would be the current state of the economy. And just to put a few numbers behind that, we lost 9 million jobs to the recession. The job growth we've seen in the recovery hasn't been enough to keep up with population growth. So we actually need to make up 12 million jobs now to get back to normal labor market conditions. The unemployment rate has been above 8% for almost 3 years now. That's unprecedented since World War II. And the underemployment rate, if you count folks who are not working as many hours as they'd like, or who have given up looking for work because they're so discouraged, then you're at 15% of the workforce. And then just another pernicious element of the labor market situation is that 40% of the unemployed have been without jobs for 6 months or longer. And every day they go without jobs is either losing skills, their attachment to the labor force is eroding, And it makes it harder to put these folks back to work. So what we really need to address this significant economic challenge is we need a two-part plan. And the first part is measures that address the short-run labor market problems, partly through boosting aggregate demand. So the president had, you know, he in his Labor Day speech, he put out a package that would essentially do this. And he came back to some of those measures last night. He talked about extending the payroll tax cut. He talked about more infrastructure spending. He talked about ways to get workers back into to help them find jobs. And he added a few new things. So most significantly, he added a proposal, which would have to be passed by Congress, to have the FHA refinance underwater mortgages that were issued by private issuers as opposed to Fannie and Freddie, such that they can take advantage of the really low interest rates the Fed has created for us. So he did list these things, but he didn't package them together, and he didn't put any specific numbers behind it. So he didn't really lay out a clear plan there. But then there's the second part of what we need to do now, and that is to address our long-run debt problems. And, you know, people argue it's not a big deal for the economy right now because these problems aren't showing through to financial markets in the form of higher interest rates on long-run government bonds. But I think that's just wrong. I think these debt problems are creating this cloud of uncertainty about, you know, whether financial markets will suddenly react and how the government's going to tackle these problems, what that will mean for firms and businesses, and that is hindering firms and businesses from planning, from spending, from hiring. And again, the president kind of hinted about the deficit issue. He talked about specific ways that you could reduce the deficit. The blueprint has a sentence saying we need a plan to tackle our long-run deficit problems. But he didn't really come close to laying out a clear, comprehensive plan. And so just to sum up, I think there certainly were interesting elements of the speech. But I think the lack of a clear fiscal plan really was a disservice to the economy. I think people might say, oh, it was the right thing to do politically. None of this stuff will pass anyway this year, so what difference does it make? But I think it is a disservice in the sense that it's not focusing the national conversation on what needs to be done. And that could end up being quite relevant next year when we come to actually tackle these problems, or worse yet, if something unexpected happens, if we take another body blow to the economy and we do suddenly have to deal with these problems.
That sort of gets us right into the politics, which I said we wouldn't be dealing with, because that, I mean, the presumption of your argument is that somehow election campaigns sort of create the basis of a mandate that then empower and motivate those elected to act in a fashion that will resolve them. It becomes very tricky when you have divided party government in a time of sort of intensely polarized political parties. And if I were to ask you what is the Republican plan for dealing with our short-term and long-term stimulus and deficit debt problem, how would you respond to that?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not, you know, implying that there's a better answer on the other side. I just do think that someone needs to get out there. I actually think it's been a problem that nobody's been out there really, you know, laying this out clearly and I mean, laying out the need for a plan, laying out the need to sit down and create a plan, because I think it's something that our national needs to be in our national conversation.
Yeah. Maybe we'll pick up on this later, because this debate is very much present in Europe now, where the focus has been almost entirely on deficits and debt and austerity programs to deal with them. And now you're gradually seeing a change in sentiment, and that for God's sake, what we need to do is get these economies growing again, and cutting spending offers, other than sort of somehow reducing uncertainty, doesn't promise much in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that was, I think that's right. And I think, you know, I think the lesson we should take from Europe is that, you know, let's let's figure it out now before. I mean, like I said, I think there'll be an opportunity to figure it out after the election is over, and we don't have to worry about these political issues. But I think, you know, on top of that, there's a real chance that we could suffer some sort of unexpected negative shock to the economy. And the IMF was out yesterday, you know, talking about the dismal prospects for the world economy, talking about the prospects for, you know, perhaps things worsening in Europe. Those things could have a significant negative effect on our economy, such that we need to react. And if that time comes, we don't want to be caught off guard.
Fair enough. Rob, let's focus to the growth side, the job side of the agenda. The president said that we've made progress on his long-term goal of increasing exports. He talked about manufacturing, clean energy, talked about infrastructure. Is there something compelling in that package of proposals?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks, and good morning, everybody. I think that, a lot of that he talked about isn't necessarily new things. The administration, I think, has been generally consistent with that package of stuff they laid out. But kind of hearing it all last night, it is kind of packaged around a new growth model for the country, moving away from kind of the consumption-driven economy that predated the recession to one more focused on different measures of production and on the tradable sectors in order to create quality jobs and then sustain some locally serving jobs around our cities and metros. But in particular, I wanted to focus on two of the core assets that the president mentioned around exports and manufacturing and around energy and infrastructure. It's so hard to separate these things. They're kind of siloed, but when you hear them kind of last night, they are kind of all wrapped in together, and they do build off of some kind of unfinished business, I think, that started here in Washington. That's been part of the conversation, you know, for a bunch of months anyway. On manufacturing, it's clearly related to long-term growth and clearly plays a critical role in this goal for doubling exports. And when we think about exports, it's not just about, putting things in boxes and shipping them all over the place, but it really is the economic imperative of our time, given the growing demand that we're seeing, particularly from growing nations in Brazil and in India and in China. So it's really about kind of taking advantage of that enormous market demand that's emerging around the globe in order to create jobs back here, in order to have a clear role when it comes to manufacturing. I think we are on pace to meet the president's stated goal of doubling exports in 5 years. It seems like a very dubious and very, very challenging goal to meet, but it does look like that we're on track to meet that. Some of it's due to kind of quirks in the monetary system, the low value of the dollar, but some of it is definitely due to things that the president and the administration has already put in place. The Ex-Im Bank, you know, providing more and more loans, giving support and additional resources in particular to states and metropolitan areas so they can boost their, you know, their trading partners and all that. So there is a lot that's going on, and exports is clearly going to be a big focus, and it probably should be. On the energy side, you know, there was a big chunk of the speech that folks probably know that was dedicated to energy, and I think the president called it the all of the above, right, energy policy, which included everything from offshore oil drilling to clean tech. It had an energy efficiency kind of overhang, so it really did have it ran the gamut from in terms of energy policy. I think it would have been great if they had talked about, you know, maybe using some of the resources from fossil fuels to fund some of the clean tech stuff that they have going on. But again, this is energy work that's been going on in the administration for, you know, since the very beginning. But clearly, this is an area that's going to be critical to growing jobs and improving the economy. Infrastructure got another big shout out. The president has always talked about that. I think it was framed around, well, we stopped the war overseas. Let's use half that money to retire the debt. The other half goes into infrastructure. You know, it's a little more challenging to do than it was kind of laid out. But clearly, I think the main message on that is we're rebuilding countries overseas. Let's start rebuilding, you know, the U.S. infrastructure, again, in order to support manufacturing, to improve exports, to create quality jobs back here at home. It's not that kind of quality of life kind of message. It really is a straight kind of economic imperative. I think that was a really good shift. And there was also a big focus on the infrastructure message around kind of cutting through red tape, getting projects done. There's enormous frustration with how long it takes you know, to get some of these projects off the ground. It takes far too long. The administration is trying to figure out how we can prioritize certain projects and get those things done. So, again, a lot of unfinished business, I think, here in Washington, things that they reiterated and brought back up. What was left unsaid, I think, has to do really with you know, the heart of all of these issues, and that's out in our states and our metropolitan areas. Again, if we're trying to double exports, you know, if we're trying to improve on clean tech, I mean, all these issues are really rooted on the state and metropolitan level, given the dysfunction that's happening, you know, here in Washington. And I think the president said it himself, kind of some pessimism that the really important things are going to get done. There is an awful lot that's going on outside of Washington in the states and the metropolitan areas. We've got to capture some of that innovation. So while the president, I think, did a good job kind of portraying himself as a you know, federal president and talking to Congress about what Congress can do, really needs to become more of a national president and talk about what we can do in a partnership with states, metros, and particularly the private sector.
Rob, I was struck by yet another effort to try to figure out how to pay for and thereby persuade Republicans in Congress to launch a serious infrastructure bank. It seems like a gimme. That is to say, right now, interest rates are as low as we can ever imagine them. It's almost like we can't afford not to borrow for things that will prove productive over the long haul. It just gets more expensive over time. Why? What's holding it up? And this looked like a pretty gimmicky way that is, oh, we'll take the money we're saving from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That was purely rhetorical. Is there any serious talk about getting the infrastructure bank going?
And it's also clearly important. He also talked about the construction jobs and just how hard those have been hit. So yeah. It does seem like a gimme. It's really a very, not even bipartisan, a nonpartisan issue. Again, when you leave Washington, you talk to folks outside the Beltway, there isn't a very different message when it comes to infrastructure. People clearly understand the priority that we have to rebuild what's in place now and then put in place that kind of infrastructure that's going to propel us into the 21st century. Funding it is clearly going to be, you know, the big challenge. There are lots of ideas that are out there, taking more advantage of public-private partnerships, taking advantage of perhaps some foreign direct investments. This is a little bit of the speech last night. So there are lots of ideas about how we can do that. But I think that it's not just around finding the money to do it, but we've got to figure out ways to cut through some of the regulatory red tape that's holding these projects up. Environmental regulations get a lot of the focus of that, but it's not the only thing that's holding these projects up. And clearly when you go overseas, you realize just how important it is that we have some of these protections in place. But we have to focus on those projects that are clearly meeting measures of national standards. Again, if we're trying to double exports in 5 years, that clearly leads you down a path to certain investments, particularly around our ports, for example. They're widening the Panama Canal. We're going to have gigantic ships floating up the Atlantic coast and nowhere to dock because the ports are too small. They can't handle them. They need to be dredged and all that kind of business. That's a national priority. That really needs to be something that we focus on with a laser because, again, we're going to not be able to do all these other national objectives unless we have infrastructure that's still in the 20th century.
Karen, one of the catchier parts of the speech, which we saw coming for weeks, if not months, was the Buffett tax, which I take as a new alternative minimum tax for millionaires and billionaires. Is there any value associated with that proposal other than political?
I think the answer is we don't know yet. We really haven't we haven't seen the details on what exactly this means. It was an interesting, catchy part of the speech, and I don't know. You know, I think, you know, there was this general theme of fairness, and I think to the extent that the president is worried there about the stagnation in median wages in this country, I agree with him 100% that that's a real problem. Can I just comment on some of the stuff that Rob was saying? You know, I think that fairness and the median wage stagnation that was behind some of this emphasis on manufacturing and I largely agree with what Rob said, but one part of that part of the speech that made me uneasy was this. There were parts of the discussion that really kind of smacked of industrial policy, and for example, we saw he talked about tax preferences for manufacturers, maybe especially for high-tech manufacturers. He talked about it in the context of clean energy, and I think that's where we really need to be super cautious. I mean, I understand the idea that we want good jobs for the middle class, but I think we do need to be super cautious when it comes to things like industrial policy. History has taught us that we just aren't good at picking winners. And I think, this last resurfaced in a kind of passionate way in the 1980s when we had this fascination with what was going on in Japan, and in particular whether some of the efforts by their Ministry of International Trade and Industry were what explained the high growth in Japan. And I think, as history unfolded, it's turned out that there's a lot of skepticism about whether those initiatives really did Japan good and whether their economic success was really explained by more standard things like a high saving rate and good tax and business policy. So
that's a good segue, Eshwar, into the international economic issues. There was a lot of talk about outsourcing and policies to persuade, if not compel, corporations to create jobs here. There was a bit of protectionist rhetoric directed to China and elsewhere. It was really quite an aggressive speech in that sense. But were there implied policies underneath that suggested some turn, or does it strike you mainly as sort of typical election year, let's stand up for American jobs rhetoric?
I'll start with a big picture, Tom. The fact is, the rest of the world, well, most of the rest of the world, except perhaps some pockets of Pakistan and Afghanistan, love President Obama. The sad reality is they aren't going to be much help to President Obama in his re-election campaign. One can think, stepping back from the speech a little bit, about the context in which President Obama was framing his discussion of international economic policy. Two issues dominate. One is Europe. The second is jobs, which is a domestic issue but has an international element. On Europe, the general sense is that things are getting worse. I'm an optimist. I think things are going to get better before they get really bad. And the timing is not going to work well for President Obama, because I suspect that we will see some significant progress or apparent progress in the context of Europe in the next couple of months that will pull them back from the cliff. But the Eurozone project, as it's presently structured, is not sustainable, and I think these tensions will come home to bear in the latter half of the year. Not good timing for President Obama, but there's not a great deal he can do about it. We have Secretary Geithner, other minions of the government there trying to persuade the Europeans to do the right thing. I don't think the U.S. is going to be able to accomplish very much on that score. The second issue is jobs. Every country around the world wants jobs, not just the U.S., but even countries that are apparently doing well. Many of the emerging markets, like China, haven't been able to deliver much job growth despite high economic growth. And everybody is looking to the export sector to generate jobs. And this is where there is a tension between what President Obama is trying to do and what the rest of the world is trying to do. Because the paradox remains that the U.S., despite all of its weaknesses, still remains the big bad gorilla around. And the U.S. economy has started recovering, and there is a sense in the rest of the world the U.S. coattails are still the best ones to hang on to. Now, countries like China are growing fast and are likely to continue growing very fast over the next couple of years. But the reality is that the sort of imports that China takes in, especially if it's going to continue with its investment-led growth, is not really going to help the U.S. So, on the exports front, what did President Obama's speech offer? As is typical, it offered red meat and whatever the less carnivorous equivalent is, perhaps tofu, some real content in terms of policies. And what I found interesting was a segue from the more protectionist sort of talk to the more policy-oriented issues. On what might be interpreted as protectionist sentiment, I think the administration has already laid down a very clear line in the sand that it is not going to sit back and tolerate what it sees as unfair competition from other countries, with China, of course, being the primary competitor. Now, what the U.S. has done in terms of concrete accomplishments, of course, is sign a few free trade agreements with Korea, Panama, and Colombia, and those are trumpeted in the speech. Now, the reality is that the amount of exports to Panama and Colombia are not that great. Korea right now accounts for less than 5% of U.S. exports. So even the vision of millions of Koreans buying American cars, I think, is not going to come to fruition anytime very soon. Now, it's true that exports have gone up a lot in the last couple of years, but it's off a level that it shrunk quite significantly during the time of the global financial crisis. So right now, exports are up only about $200 billion relative to where they were in the year before the crisis, 2007. The interesting thing is, of the countries, of the big trading partners that the U.S. has, there is one country to which exports from the U.S. have actually doubled over the last 5 years. That country happens to be China. The paradox, of course, is that at the same time, the U.S. bilateral trade deficit with China has been rising over time. So there is this awkwardness in the sense that one would like more market access in China, but at the same time, the U.S. is going to be forced into a position where, because of political winds on the Hill, it's going to be important to be very tough on China. China, of course, is going through its own leadership transition in the next 12 to 18 months, so they're going to be in no mood to back down. And the problem is not just about China. Ultimately, the way these two big powers tango is going to have fairly serious implications for the overall global trading regime. And that, in a sense, is going to be a real concern. And President Obama's speech lays down a marker for China, and I think it's going to lead to much more heated rhetoric. But at the top level in both countries, my sense is that sense will prevail, and we will not have too much of a flashpoint on this particular issue. What I found interesting in this speech, again, was the nice segue from domestic to international policies, because he does make the point that America needs to be more competitive if it is going to export more and get more jobs in the exporting sector and stanch outsourcing. There are taxes and other policies that come into play, but ultimately he does make it an issue of American competitiveness. And I think the segue from talking about international policies and trying to assure a level playing field and then talking about what policies are necessary to ensure American competitiveness on that level playing field was, I think, a sensible tone to take. So he hit, in my view, the right elements on the international side, and I suspect we'll see a lot more of that in the coming year. Engagement with allies, engagement with those who are seen as our competitors, and at the same time, a tough line on our competitors, especially China. So I think it set the right tone for the year ahead.
Well, that's an upbeat report. I wanted to ask you about one specific proposal, which he didn't elaborate, but is very much there, which is corporate tax reform and the notion of a global minimum tax as a way of persuading companies in many respects to avoid, stay away from some of the tax avoidance strategies and actually for resources to come back home. Is that a silly idea, a reasonable idea, or what?
It may matter, but only at the margin. Frankly, I think it's important to talk about tax competition, and given the attention that is being paid to this issue, especially in Europe and especially as it relates to the financial sector, it's something that we will have to deal with over the latter half of this year. But frankly, I think that in substantive terms, the other elements of the speech, thinking about issues like infrastructure, the U.S. fiscal deficit, those are far bigger problems. And as Karen pointed out, I think the rest of the world would also have liked to see some clearer view about what is going to be done to tackle the U.S. Fiscal problem in the long term. Now, I can sense that going into the election season, he may not have wanted to throw puffballs that the Republicans could easily swing at, but laying out a vision for what should have been done over the long term, at least in terms of the objective, I think was a part of the speech that the rest of the world as well was looking forward to, because Europe is a big problem right now, but the amount of public debt that the U.S. is accumulating is going to be a source of global financial instability in the years ahead. And a clearer message on that, I think, would have been well received by the rest of the world.
It was noticeable that there was not a single reference, by my recollection, to Simpson Bowles or any of the efforts to try to reach an agreement. I think it's clear the president came to a belief, if not a realization, that he really had no negotiating partner on Capitol Hill, that what the Republicans have in mind is a plan that he would consider radical and, in fact, counterproductive because of the tax cutting rather than tax increasing elements to it. So he decided to play it strictly by the politics of this election year. And other than a throwaway saying he's been ready, he was ready in the spring. He looked back at Speaker Boehner, and he said he would continue to be ready to talk about restructuring the safety net programs to deal with these problems, but obviously was not interested in re-engaging on that. Martin, the president began and ended his speech with really quite moving references to American servicemen and women, the beginning at Andrews visiting the last troops coming home from Iraq, the end, another refrain on the taking out of Osama bin Laden and the SEALs and the rest. He obviously takes great pride on delivering on his promise to end the war in Iraq, and he hinted at the beginning of the end of the war in Afghanistan. But then there's Iran. Surprises do have a way of, like financial crises in Europe and other things, of making a mess of the best laid plans. How does the national security front look to you?
Well, interestingly, Tom, you know, politics are supposed to end at the waterfront, and foreign policy is supposed to be bipartisan. And in fact, compared to the incredible polarization that we see in domestic politics and the gridlock on Capitol Hill, there has been an amazing amount of bipartisanship in foreign policy during Obama's first 3 years. But what we saw last night was the use of foreign policy for political ends, which again is unusual. Normally, Democratic candidates for the presidency are concerned about the vulnerability of foreign policy for them, that they'll be portrayed by their Republican adversaries as weak on foreign policy. So it's normally something that is not used in a political season. But here the president did it, and I think did it quite effectively in the way that you suggested. First of all, by playing on the fact that he is ending two wars in the greater Middle East. This could easily be portrayed as weakness, but in fact, it's immensely popular across the political spectrum, and there are only very few Republicans, Senator McCain and maybe Senator Lieberman, I guess he's not a Republican yet at least, but that's it. There is a great resonance behind the idea that we are bringing the troops home. And so he plays on that, and I thought used it very effectively as the spine of his speech in terms of turning that into a patriotic moment rather than a moment of weakness that, you know, we're pulling out, we're withdrawing from the world. No, we're coming home with our heads held high, and we should be emulating the example of our great warriors So I thought that was a particularly effective use of foreign policy for political purposes. And, of course, the crowning point, the jewel in this crown is he got Osama bin Laden. And that, more than anything else, makes him Teflon when it comes to any kind of attack from the Republicans in this campaign season. In terms of policy that you saw coming out of this speech, the first point is the one that Eshwar has already made, which is about China in the context of jobs. And here, I think what we saw was not just politics, but also a very strong personal feeling on the part of the president that the Chinese are basically not playing the game by the rules. They're acting unfairly at the expense of American jobs, and so he's going to take a stand on this. He feels personally quite angry about it, and so I think it's not just politics. There's policy behind this. How it plays in the context of the bilateral relationship with China is going to be important to watch, because China itself is not going through an election, but it's going through a leadership change this year as well. And there is an expectation, I think, on both sides, in both governments, that this is going to be a rocky year in the relationship, but that, you know, we have to kind of keep it within bounds. Both sides are going to be playing to their publics, but it needs to be kept within bounds. And that is going to be the challenge for the president in the way that he handles this. Second issue that he raised was the Arab awakenings and what is happening there. And what is interesting to note was that he did it in a way that was measured. None of the freedom agenda of George Bush. He did not play to his inner Obama in this regard, which is to bend history in the direction of justice. That's the inner Obama. But notwithstanding the great courage and dignity of the Arab people in toppling their governments and demanding freedom and democracy, his was very measured in recognition of that. And in particular, when it came to Syria, which is the big question of are we going to actually do something beyond sanctions to topple this brutal leader, he basically was more professorial. You know, Assad will come to understand that he can't stand against the will of his people, but nothing about we're going to make him understand it through the force of our intervention. And then finally, there was Iran. And Iran, he was very tough on. He made very clear, rhetorically, it was close to banging his hand on the podium. He didn't do that, but that was the essence of the passion, which he said, America will not allow Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, and all options are on the table, meaning the military option is on the table. And, of course, that would be the ultimate irony in this situation, that he wants to show in the political season that he is tough on Iran. Precisely, that's where the only criticism he gets in foreign policy is that from the Republican candidates in the debates is that they'll be tougher than him on Iran. Mitt Romney has said, you know, if he's president, Iran will have nuclear weapons. If I'm president, Iran won't. So here's the president kind of saying, I'm going to double down on this one. I'm going to match you and raise you. I'm going to take care of Iran's nuclear weapons. So it would be the ultimate irony that the president who has, in effect, is in the process of ending these two wars in the Middle East, would, as a result of the need to be tough towards Iran, end up getting involved in a third war in the Middle East. Last point is that he made a very stirring point about how America is back. And all around the world, people and governments are looking to America to take the lead. And it was quite stirring rhetoric in which he said, America remains the one indispensable nation in world affairs. And as long as I'm president, I intend to keep it that way. That's very interesting language, and it is a radical departure from Barack Obama, the multilateralist who's trying to shape an emerging global order in which the rising powers of China and India and Brazil and Turkey are all going to have a place at the high table along with the United States. That kind of policy, which led to one of his senior aides describing it as leading from behind, a rather unfortunate choice of words, but it did capture much of his approach, which I think happens to be the right approach to the challenges that we're facing in the world. But in this political season, he wanted to take on the declinists. He wanted to say, to the Republicans who are accusing him of not taking a stand for America, that he's going to ensure that America remains the indispensable nation. I don't think captures where his policy is, but it does capture where the way in which foreign policy is being used for political purposes in this campaign season.
That's a fascinating point. That struck me more than anything else in the speech. And if you think about it, it goes directly to the Republican attacks on, is he really an American? And doesn't he really think ours is a country in decline? He doesn't really understand who we are. And I thought this was the strongest assertive statement on that point, but other pieces of the speech were very much connected to
his grandfather and grandmother and their role in the war.
I wanted to follow up with one piece on Iran, because you gave us some insights into the inner Obama on some other matters. I'd love to know if the inner Obama confronts what could easily be a choice. Either Iran gets a nuclear weapon or weaponry, and we deal with it as we've dealt with situations similar in the past through containment of various sorts, or we join what seems to be the growing drumbeat for military strikes in Iran, which I would imagine potentially could put us in a new war and a rather extended one in that part of the world. Where's the inner Obama on that choice?
I think he's conflicted. I think that if you pose it in the kind of extreme scenario of Iran deciding to break out, throwing the inspectors out, and making a dash for nuclear weapons, because it's putting all of the capabilities in place to be able to do that. I think in that extreme case, Obama could well order a military strike. That's not his preference. He doesn't want to start a third war in the Middle East. But if the Iranians go for it, I think that ultimately he would do it. Why? It's not about politics. It's about the new world order that he's trying to help construct and shape. It's about, you know, if Iran abrogates its commitments under the Non-Proliferation Treaty in the face of the whole world opposing it, and that triggers an arms race in the Middle East or an Israeli military strike on Iran, one of the principal foundations of the emerging international order is going to collapse. And I think that will be his justification for it. And it's why he's told the military to prepare for that possibility. And Leon Panetta has made very clear that that option is on the table. But that's what I say in extremis. I think that in order to try to prevent that from happening, he is now focused on trying to get the international community behind these very strong, what he calls crippling sanctions, to try to convince the Iranians that they should come back to the table and negotiate curbs on their nuclear weapons. But again, you know, it's the multiple ironies of the Middle East that in order to stave off military action, he pushes very hard on the sanctions, which has the effect of pushing the Iranians back to the wall, and then they decide either to strike out in some other way with terrorism or closing the Straits of Hormuz or going for the breakout strategy. And so, you know, the unintended consequence of all of this effort to avoid war could indeed lead us in the end to a war. And so we're in a very tense and dangerous period at the moment.
We have about 10 minutes to entertain your questions. We have mics, so please let me see a hand emerging or two. Let's start with the gentleman right there.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. And all the presentations were quite positive, and Obama's going in the right direction, except on the financial issue and dealing with the financial problems. How likely is it that the financial problems are going to override everything everybody else said?
Karen, would you like to?
So you mean financial, you're talking about our debt,
right.
The unsustainable trajectory of the federal debt. So we don't know, and this was part of the point I was trying to make. I mean, people are quick to argue that it's not a problem because we haven't seen U.S. Government interest rates go up. And that is just kind of a standard way that people look at it. You know, if investors were really afraid that we weren't going to repay our debt, then we'd see these interest rates go up, and then we'd see the economy hurt through that channel. And we haven't seen those interest rates go up, but there are lots of explanations for why they haven't gone up, and Ishwar may be able to speak to them as well. I think part of the explanation is, well, if you're not going to invest in U.S. government bonds, where do you want to take your money? I mean, not Europe, right? So we don't know how likely these problems are to blow up. You know, as I said, even though we haven't seen this show through to interest rates, I do think it is a problem for the economy because it's creating this cloud of uncertainty about the possibility they could blow up. I think we should take a cautionary lesson from Europe and from 3 years ago when we were at the height of the financial crisis, that financial markets can change, you know, very suddenly. Investor sentiment, it's a tricky thing.
Eshwar?
Yeah, so the U.S. is benefiting from the fact that it still has the biggest, deepest, most liquid bond market in the world. And in fact, this problem you're talking about, the U.S. debt, is actually the U.S. providing even more of those services to the rest of the world. How obliging of us. And the problem is that the rest of the world is in turmoil, and there aren't any other good financial markets that can take on this burden at a time of global financial turmoil. Now, the problem for the U.S., of course, is that while it keeps our interest rates low, it goes against the strategy of boosting exports if the currency is going to remain very strong relative to other currencies. So in this, as in many other issues, there is a mixed blessing to be seen. And I think what Obama is, again, pointing out in the rest of his speech is that the U.S. needs to do a lot more, setting all of these issues aside, in order to deal with its fundamental competitiveness issues for the long term.
Let me add just a slightly contrary note on the score. I think another reason, other than the dollar is the only secure currency and people are willing to pay us to hold it, is another fact, which is that the status quo now works to the advantage of the deficit and debt problem. That is to say, the agreements in place may not be very smart cutting, but it's cutting on the spending side, and the expiration of the tax cuts in and of itself with the discipline on spending would basically turn the situation around dramatically for the intermediate term and give us the decade we need to begin to slow healthcare costs, which is where the long-term problem resides. Now, it's true, the economy would be too soft to absorb that big a hit at the beginning of 2013, but that's a really powerful status quo that a president could work with to make progress on this issue. On the other hand, leading with his chin on a plan for deficit reduction in the face of a Republican plan to dramatically cut taxes, in the case of some, eliminate all capital gains and dividends taxes, would set him up politically to lose the election. So this is a case where the policy baseline and the politics, I think, overwhelms the case for a vision on deficits and debt, especially given the reality of where interest rates are now and the programs in place. Next question. Yes, sir.
I'm Bill Klein. I'm a retired physician. I don't think I heard the word inflation last night. As a retired person, I fear inflation far more than I do a modest tax increase, which would happen if you let the Bush tax cuts expire lock, stock, and barrel. I'm just wondering where you think inflation fits in and if there's a risk in the future of a sudden burst of inflation that will just surprise everybody as if they hadn't been watching.
I can speak to this. I understand the concern. It is, as I've spent years forecasting the economy at the Federal Reserve Board, and forecasting is a tricky business. I think right now, the greater worry is actually not that inflation is going to take off. It's that inflation is going to start, we're going to see disinflation and maybe even sink below zero, which, by the way, would make our economic problems worse because it's hard enough for people to pay off their debts now. You know, imagine if wages started falling because prices were falling, then it's even harder to pay off those debts. It's hard to see where the inflation would come from. So labor costs right now are just extremely soft, and that's because of the soft state of labor markets. We did see this burst of commodity price inflation a year ago. People were very worried about that, but the fact is that the increases in commodity prices have kind of leveled off. So I think the one thing that people worry about is some sudden change in public sentiment such that they started to expect hyperinflation. And that could then become self-fulfilling because if you expect it, then if you're a business person, you're going to set your prices higher. But it's just, again, it's just in the current economic climate where there's just so much what we would call slack in the economy, it's just hard to see it happening.
Ashwar, want to add to that?
Yeah, there's nothing obvious on the horizon that makes inflation the key problem we should be worrying about. It's really growth, but you're certainly right that one cannot rule out the possibility that we reach a tipping point with the level of debt and with the amount of money in the economy that it does create a problem. But it's something that we've decided to postpone given all the problems we have to deal with right now.
Garrett?
Thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to pose a question that I think covers three of the disciplines on the stage, government, economic, and the metropolitan studies arena. And it's ironically triggered by a comment that Martin made about the sort of relative bipartisanship on foreign policy during the last few years that we haven't either paid much attention to or it hasn't gotten much notice. And here's the question for the three of you. 20 years ago, your colleague Alice Riblin wrote a book called Reviving the American Dream, in which she talked about a kind of new federalism, if I may put it that way. And then a short time ago, she and Bruce Katz from the Metropolitan Studies Group talked about this notion of the new federalism, in which, for a variety of reasons that I won't go into here, the states are probably ready and capable to assume some of the burden that the federal government has been assuming, and so that what we might look for over the course of the next few administrations is some formation, some form of this new federalism that could be as anecdotal as having governors and perhaps even mayors participating in super committees and then stepping up from that to ways in which actual programs and projects and initiatives are taken over by the states, so that you would have some form of, I hate the term revenue sharing, but revenue sharing and work sharing, and in other words, a different look at how governance in the country ought to look going ahead. And my question is this. Is that a realistic, from a political point of view? B, is it realistic from a governance and financing point of view? And C, do you see any signs, either in the speech last night or in the rhetoric that sort of leads up to it, that there may be some thinking in that regard, either in the Obama administration or somewhere in the depths of Congress?
Rob, why don't you begin?
Sure, thanks. On the latter, I don't know to the extent the speech kind of hinted to that. I think there were some references to kind of race to the top, some education reforms, I think, that clearly were designed to spur innovation when it comes to education on the state level. I don't know if the rest of it did that. In fact, I think one of the critiques that we had from this is that it did seem very federally focused, right? And again, it was kind of the president talking to Congress, you know, what they can do together, and it really left out exactly where you were going, that so much of the action is happening on the state and the metropolitan level. So that old pyramid structure we had before of the federal government on top kind of raining resources down on the states and metros has really been flipped, right? And so much of all this is kind of bottom up, this innovation that's happening. And the issues that I kind of ran through on exports, on energy, on infrastructure, we're not looking to Washington to be the innovator when it comes to this. So, and we talked about the infrastructure bank. That was a good example that Tom raised. Conversation here on the national level has been going on for decades, I suppose. It's always the next greatest idea. The states are actually doing this. There's a tri-state thing that's happening in the West. There are some cities that are working on it. Connecticut has their green bank for energy innovation. So we're going to have to look far more to the states and the metros for this innovation. It is around, I think you're right, kind of remaking American federalism. And thinking about what are those things that the federal government has to pay attention to because they're national in scope and the things that the federal government has to do. But so much of this is really being taken over by this pragmatic caucus of governors and mayors and private sector leaders all across the country that are crafting their own solutions because it's a big country, right? And the solutions for, you know, around exports in Los Angeles are going to look very different than they do in Wichita, for example. So we've got to capture that innovation, we've got to translate it, and we've got to make sure that those lessons are being shared among the states and metropolitan areas, and that we're not just waiting for Washington to send them down from up top.
But remember, the ideological polarization of the parties and the strategic partisan battles are not limited to Washington. They are found in most of the states. If you want to know which states are filing the suit to declare the individual mandate unconstitutional, look to see the party of the governor and attorney general. Look at Wisconsin and Ohio and Florida and get a sense of the extent to which ideology is really dominating politics. So we've got cross-cutting currents. We've got very pragmatic mayors and leaders in metropolitan areas who are working with government and doing really impressive things to build the new economy. And yet we have ideologues in place and utter war breaking out in state capitals that are no different from what's been happening in Washington. The question is which way we end up going.
You're right, and we think the mayors, I mean, there's so much innovation that's coming out of these. The party, generally, it's aligned. I mean, there's a lot of big city Democrat mayors. But you can't forget about the states. I mean, there's so much of their ability to act and to their flexibility relies on having a state that's willing to work with them. And you know, we've still got 30-something new governors that are in. They've only been in for 18 months or so. They're still on the hook for acting. They've got their own budgets to balance. And you've got Republican governors in places like Michigan and Tennessee and Democrats in New York and Colorado all saying generally the same thing, particularly when it comes to these elements of the productive economy. Sure, there's always going to be the political polarization, and some of the state capitals are crazy, dysfunctional. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, if we're looking to where we're going to hang our hats in the near term, you still have to look to the states.
Listen, Art, it's time to pass the baton. The one thing we didn't talk about that I think was very important, I'm sure Bill Galston will bring up, which was the president's discussion of his former body, a job in it, the United States Senate, and recommendations for reform of the filibuster. Maybe nothing could be as important as that in terms of politics and process. But for now, please join me in thanking our colleagues.